to Spotlights. This is the podcast for the Yale Forum on Religion and Ecology. As usual, I'm your host, Sam Mickey, and this week I'm really happy to welcome onto the program Rabbi Ora Nitkin-Kaner. Rabbi Ora, thanks for joining us. Thanks for making time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
So you're a Reconstructionist rabbi and interdenominational climate change chaplain based in New Haven, Connecticut, but you do work more broadly using Zoom, and the internet connects us all. So I want to talk a lot about what climate change chaplaincy looks like. But first, I just want to hear how you get into this work. That's generally how I kind of start podcast episodes, is people's kind of origin story. And, you know, sometimes that goes back really far. If you're like, well, when I was 4 years old, and it goes from there, or sometimes it's something that maybe happened in high school or college. Or so, and two parts of that, like, why become a rabbi? And then why connect that work to climate change?
Mm, yeah. So the two-parter is going to make me go back a little bit farther than just like why climate change chaplaincy, but I'll try to keep it pretty brief. So why a rabbi? I think I can trace back to 2008. So I was living and working in New Orleans, and I was working with exonerees, so formerly wrongfully incarcerated folks. And as part of that work, I was going regularly into prisons, specifically into Angola, which is the sort of nickname for Louisiana's maximum security penitentiary. And I realized over the course of several years working with exonerees that I thought that I wanted to do criminal justice reform work as like an advocate and an agitator and someone with a moral voice. So I thought about going into academia, and I thought about going into rabbinical school. And I received some really wise advice from a mentor who said, you know, it's very hard for an academic to also be an activist. You know, in some ways you can have more of a platform if you're a clergy person. Mm-hmm. And so I started rabbinical school in 2011, graduated in 2016, or was ordained in 2016. And I think that some of my thinking in becoming a rabbi was, I really resonated with the saying that the role of clergy is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And so when I started rabbinical school, you know, it felt like there were some pretty clear delineations between who was the comfortable and who was the afflicted inside and outside of Jewish community. And I would say, you know, in the intervening years, and certainly up till now and into the foreseeable future, those lines have really, really started blurring. I started to think about, you know, what kind of rabbi I wanted to be in rabbinical school. I got some experience in working in congregations, working in hospital chaplaincy, working with elders. And after I was ordained, I worked in a hospital back in New Orleans for a year, and then was the rabbi of a congregation in Ann Arbor, Michigan for 5 years. And during that time, we had, you know, the after effects of the 2016 election. We had the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh. Right. We had the start of the pandemic. And increasingly what I was hearing from my congregants back in Michigan, and just, you know, like general conversations with folks, was things are not okay. This sense of dread, this sense of increased fear, this sense that things were really unraveling. And I think the backdrop for all of these fears and increased despair was often the backdrop of climate change, whether or not people were able to recognize and name that, or whether they were. And I started to wonder, is there such a thing as a climate change chaplain? Like, does this title, does this role even exist? And this was a few years ago. The answer is like mostly not so much. There were just a couple of like folks working in this field. So that sort of planted the seeds for me. And then this is sort of like I guess you could call this my origin moment or my origin story for climate change chaplaincy specifically, and why I named my practice Exploring Apocalypse, which I'll get into in, you know, in a few minutes. So I was hiking with my partner in, I think it was like rural Michigan or maybe rural Ohio. This was probably like 2020. And as, you know, we were on this like multi-hour hike in the forest, in the mountains. And over the course of our hike, we passed two different dyads, like two different pairs of people. And at the moment that we were passing them, one of them was using the word apocalypse to describe the present moment. And this happened twice. And so, you know, I think it's highly unlikely that that was, you know, like an apocalypse themed, like hiking group that just happened to split up. I think the reality is that like a lot of folks were naming and really feeling apocalypse.
Right. Yeah. Wow. That's yeah. What an interesting synchronicity. Like an apocalypse themed hiking group does sound fun though.
Maybe nowadays that does exist. Who knows?
Yeah. If it doesn't, somebody might need to get that going. Yeah. Well, so then specifically, what is the work of a climate change chaplain or a chaplain in general for people who don't know? Because that's one of the things that we try to, you know, address all religions on this podcast. And so there's sometimes some of the vocabulary people might not like, what's a chaplain?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I think most people don't really know what a chaplain does or only have like a very loose sense of what chaplains do or in what settings you might find a chaplain or what right. you might reach out to a chaplain for. So the basics is that a chaplain provides spiritual care in times of suffering and in places where suffering is taking place. And chaplains are, you know, meant to help a person to access their spiritual resources and their emotional resources and to make meaning amidst the uncertainty of the situation that they find themselves in. And the effects of meeting with a chaplain or speaking with a chaplain, especially over time, results in the person who is in a space or a time of suffering, ideally feeling more seen, feeling affirmed, feeling less alone, and feeling more connected.
Right.
So that's the basics of like, what does a chaplain do? And those aspects and those intentions and those effects are also true of climate change chaplaincy. So I work with individuals, I help them uncover their emotional, spiritual resources in the face of climate change. And I help the people I work with make meaning in the face of the profound uncertainties of the climate crisis.
Very well said. That's a succinct definition. Anytime somebody's like, what's a chaplain? I'm going to have to send them a clip from this episode. Well, and I know that you have some background at my alma mater, the California Institute of Integral Studies. So I wonder if you could share how you got involved there and what kind of training you got that supports your work as a climate change chaplain.
Yeah. So like I mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, back in 2020, I think I was starting to question, is there such a thing as climate change chaplaincy? And then as I was thinking more about what a climate change chaplaincy practice would look like, I started to wonder, you know, what kind of training exists in order to sort of bolster my existing skills and existing training in chaplaincy, you know, sort of like more normative or conventional chaplaincy. And, you know, the reality is that there was absolutely no training for climate change chaplains specifically. So I started to hunt around for what sort of might be adjacent to this field. And where I landed was the California Institute of Integral Studies was about to launch their inaugural climate psychology certificate program. And so that was an incredible training, mostly hearing from, learning from And also most of my colleagues were psychologists and psychotherapists. So climate aware psychologists and climate aware psychotherapists. Okay. And, you know, I was lucky enough that in this first iteration of this training program, they were also making it available to allied professionals. And so I applied and, you know, I was thankfully considered an allied professional as a rabbi and a future climate change chaplain. And so I got to do some really rich and wonderful learning with them.
That's great. Yeah. And a cool program. And it's very heartening to see how much the world of psychology and therapy has sort of taken on some of this work of, you know, ecological psychology, climate psychology, addressing things like eco-anxiety. And so, yeah, I would think, especially at a place like CIIS, where their psychology is understood very much in terms of spirituality in a lot of cases. So, of course, allied professional. And in a way, I think sometimes of a chaplain as something like a spiritual therapist. Mm. And sort of, depending on how those words are used. So that's great. Well, okay. So now we have to get back to the apocalypse, and because that's a pretty loaded word, and to some people just sounds like, oh, catastrophe, the end of the world kind of stuff. It's like, well, end of the world, you know, eschatology and stuff. It's a little different than what apocalypse is really about. And of course, it's different for different traditions as well. You know, Jewish understandings of apocalypse, different than Christian understandings, even within Christianity, different denominations. So what's your approach to apocalypse? Because as you said, you named your practice Exploring Apocalypse. What's the apocalypse? That doesn't sound fun, I think, for most people. I don't want to explore the apocalypse. I'd like to avoid the apocalypse.
Yeah, maybe one day soon someone will create Avoid Apocalypse as another kind of practice. So I think, you know, going back to this origin story, after hearing multiple people sort of using the word apocalypse to describe the present moment and the anticipated future moment, I started wondering, like, what does apocalypse actually mean? And as a rabbi and a human being, I love etymology. Like, I love learning about the roots of words, multiple meanings of words, where they come from. And so I started looking into, like, what is apocalypse? Where does apocalypse come from? And I learned that it comes from ancient Greek, and actually simply means to uncover or to reveal. And so in our, you know, in our present sort of like quite, you know, I think the secular world's understanding of apocalypse tends to be generally quite carrying the legacy of Christian theology when it comes to the end of the world. So, you know, imagining doom, imagining disaster, imagining an unlivable, uninhabitable world where everything is completely different than anything we've ever known. And so maybe, you know, it's possible in some ways my naming my practice Exploring Apocalypse was trying to sort of like take the language or the concept of apocalypse back, but also taking it back to its sort of its own, the word's own or the concept's own origin story of uncovering or revealing. And so what drew me to this, you know, this question of what is being uncovered or what is being revealed is that we're both looking at climate change and we're thinking about and feeling about what is being uncovered in the world. And then we're also, when we're looking at climate change, thinking about climate change, feeling about climate change, we're also, we have the opportunity and the invitation to be reflecting on what is being uncovered and what is being revealed in ourselves as individuals and in communities, so that it's not just a reaction to or against disaster. It's an opportunity to really be thoughtfully considering the invitations of this moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a much more positive spin on it than just like, oh, it's catastrophe.
Yeah.
Like, no, we're really, something's being revealed of humankind, of our relationship to the earth, to the universe for that matter. And to guide people through that really seems like such crucial work this time, especially, I mean, people are so burnt out. Climate change is a big part of that, but, you know, like you were saying, politics is bad and war, and there's just so many issues weighing on people. And so to guide them through that, be like, this can actually be a source of empowerment and building resilience. And so I wonder if you could say a little bit about the kind of work you do specifically there, because I know you work with individuals as well as groups. So what kind of offerings do you have?
Yeah, I do want to answer that question. And also want to ping back to something that you just mentioned. You know, you mentioned climate change, you mentioned war, you mentioned politics. One of my sort of underlying philosophical approaches, which I will also call an offering, because you just asked, like, what are some of my offerings? And, like, I will answer the question practically, what do I offer folks? But I want to say that I think one of my philosophical approaches that clients of mine really resonate with, because they feel seen and held when they hear it articulated, is I like to talk about not just climate change. I like to talk about climate change and other systemic unravelings. And that's because, you know, the dysregulation that we're experiencing in our climate systems, it's really happening in tandem with the dysregulation of various man-made systems, or sorry, human-made systems, or maybe actually more man-made. Actually,
yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, no offense. You know, y'all have had more power than non-cis men for a while. So there's these simultaneous dysregulations, and what I have noticed is that if we're paying attention, like if we're the kind of person who's really paying attention to the dysregulations of climate systems, we're also generally more likely to notice and feel the dysregulations of other systems. So if we're feeling enraged, or we're feeling heartbroken over the current and anticipated losses of a climate-changing world, it's also very likely that we're going to be feeling rage or heartbreak about, let's say, you know, increased fascism in Western societies, or increased legislation against, you know, the bodily autonomy of women and trans folks, or growing violence against people of color and immigrants and Muslims and Jews, or, you know, the widening gap between billionaires and the rest of us. And so one of the sentences that I hear clients saying again and again and again when we get into the chaplaincy, you know, Zoom room, is they're saying, it feels like the world is falling apart. And that's incredibly painful. That's incredibly difficult. And all of these systems dysregulating or disintegrating, I think it can feel sort of like a terrible coincidence, like, you know, thing after thing after thing, terrible thing after terrible thing after terrible thing, sort of piling on top of each other and really deeply weighing us down and deeply making us experience a feeling of fraying in our world. But the reality is that all of these things are happening at the same time, because our world systems are so interdependent. And so, of course, in a time when the natural world feels like it's falling apart, like, of course, citizens will then, you know, elect sort of strongman leaders who seem to be promising a return to stability. And, you know, of course, in a time of increasing natural disasters, people will try to protect themselves, and they'll try to protect their loved ones by hoarding wealth. And, you know, of course, when we're thinking about future scarcity, governments are going to circle the metaphorical wagons and are going to, you know, put in place more stringent regulations to keep people who are perceived as the other out. And so I think having this kind of broader or broadening perspective on climate change is often, and you know, holding a space for my clients to be articulating these, like the distresses that come with watching these multiple dysregulations happening, I think is helpful for people that I work with.
Right. Yeah, that's really one of the reasons I like studying climate change, which is a weird thing to say. We're like, it's just a horrible thing. We're like, yeah, but it's somehow a point where all the contemporary issues of our day are meeting. And so politics, economics, domestic issues, international issues, everything's kind of intersecting there. And so through the lens of climate, you're able to really address the full spectrum of kind of just existential problems that people are going through. Well, so then more specifically about what kind of offerings, what's it like in the Zoom room? And some of it's for individuals, but you also do work where there's whole groups that you're engaging.
So can I try something with you? Like, can we do a little bit of exploring together? So I'm going to turn the question or a question back to you, which is like, when you, Sam, are thinking about climate change, what are some of the questions that you're holding or the emotions that you're experiencing? Or if, you know, if you don't feel comfortable sharing that personally, you know, what are some of the emotions or thoughts that you're hearing, let's say your students express or other folks in your life?
Feel free to share something that's certainly what I'm feeling, but also my students, which is anger or just full on rage, maybe is a more appropriate term, at people's complacency and inaction and just like institutional inertia. It's hard to change institutions, even when people have their hearts in the right place, and for some reason, it's just not getting done, or it's not getting done fast enough. So a lot of anger. I certainly feel that regularly, and I have a lot of students who share that, and in classes or in papers and things like that.
Thank you for sharing that. So anger is definitely one of the emotions that a lot of my clients express. And my approach to anger specifically, or thinking on anger specifically, is anger tends to be an emotion that lives on top of other deeper emotions or other deeper sort of violations, we could call it. So usually when, you know, our emotional activation is expressing itself as anger, or we're feeling anger in our, you know, in our hearts and our bodies, typically, you know, I believe that what's underneath anger is either fear, or grief, or betrayal. So sort of like a violation of what we hold dear. So, you know, in the climate change chaplaincy Zoom room with me, we would be examining, you know, the individual, my clients, you know, experiences with anger. I would be encouraging them to articulate, you know, exactly what they're feeling angry about. And we would maybe, you know, write down a list together. And then I would be inviting them to think about, well, what is actually under the anger? So what is the fear? What are they afraid of losing? What is the grief? What is the you know, we know that grief is sort of like the flip side of love. So like, what is the love or the care that is potentially being threatened that then results into anger? Or what is okay, so if we're looking at a sense of betrayal leading to anger, a violation of values that are held dear, you know, then we would start to explore what are the values that this person is actually really holding dear. And then maybe down the line, a few sessions later, start to think about, okay, well, these are the values that feel threatened around climate change. What are the values that you would actually like to push out into the world? Or in what ways are the values that you hold an impetus towards engaging in more action or more connection when it comes to climate change?
No, that's great. When you're mentioning fear, grief, and betrayal, I'm like, oh, yep. Like, check, check, check. And geez, listing the things to be specific about, you know, anger, and like, all right, what in particular? That would be a long list. Thinking especially in terms of religions, like, I feel like there's a betrayal of all of the world's religious traditions' core values. There's not one religious tradition that's like, you know what we should do? grow our society to the point of destroying the basic life support systems of the planet. Nobody recommended that. This Confucius doesn't say that. Jesus doesn't say that. You're not getting that from Abraham or Moses. Like, maybe nobody like
the Church
saying
of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Do they believe in destruction?
You know, that's a good question. That might be the one. But so that's I think part of it to me is like we're really betraying all of our traditions. And even me, you know, at a Jesuit university, and you're like, why aren't we moving quicker? And like, this is, and then there's a lot of greenwashing around that where people are like, well, we have a new sustainability initiative. And you're like, but what's really happening here? Are we doing enough? So yeah, I appreciate that. That's really great work. And especially thinking of emotions in like ecosystems like that, like, all right, well, here's the anger, but then there's going to be a few things below it. And you, so you start to really open up the full spectrum of your emotional life.
Yeah,
that's great. All right, well, I might have to sign up. That's a great offering. And I think that's one of those things. A lot of us think we can work through these things on our own. Like, oh, it's fine. I have emotions. Well, that's part of life. And it's like, yeah, but you know, you can work through them more in a way that's you're going to have a lot more emotional resilience. You can handle things more, and also be empowered to actually do something.
Yeah. And one of the overwhelmingly consistent trends that I've noticed among my clients is how profoundly isolating it is to be living in this moment and thinking and feeling about climate change. You know, so many folks have said to me, I feel like I'm crazy, or I feel like, you know, I want to talk about this and no one is able to talk with me about it, or I want to talk about this. Some people will engage with me. And then, you know, my spouse, my parent, my child will say, I can't hear you talk anymore about this. Like, you need to stop talking. And so the isolation can lead to depression. The isolation can lead to increased anxiety. The isolation can lead to numbness. The isolation, like, most obviously can lead to a decrease in relationships and in quality of relationships. And so, you know, this is sort of going back to the work of the chaplain. You know, it's really valuable to have someone who is on your side, who is hearing what you're feeling with care, with a lack of judgment, and creating a safe space for you to really be actually feeling what you're feeling and actually wrestling with what you're wrestling. And I think that quality of gentle care and that quality of affirmation is really can be a balm for people's really raw and frayed hearts and souls at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I know for myself, it's been times where I don't realize how isolated I feel. And I realize I talk about it too much to some people. I'm like, oh, that's fine. And you just kind of brush that off without realizing, you know, over time that really wears on you. And you do start to feel, I never feel crazy because I know I'm right. and as more climate disasters happen, I'm like, oh, told you so. Yeah. And so there's a weird feeling of like, well, at least I'm right about it. But then that makes you even feel more isolated because you're like, well, it's not because I'm crazy. It's that other people are in some kind of denial about it, or they just want to, you know, not look at it and not want to address it. And so, yeah, it's important to then have a place to go where somebody's like, look, we can talk about this together.
Yeah. Yeah. And then to experience affirmation and validation in the context of climate chaplaincy sessions, then often empowers people I work with to go and have more meaningful and enriching and deeper conversations with the people that they love. So that's, you know, an added benefit.
Yeah, that's great. And it reminds me of something the climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe says, and it's that people always ask, what's the most important thing I can do to address climate change? Is it go to a plant-based diet? Is it drive less? What is it exactly? And she's like, well, it's going to be different for different people, but the most important thing everybody can do is talk about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're providing a way for people to talk about it in a non-judgmental context, which is so crucial, because sometimes talking with other activists and advocates, there's a lot of judgment, blame goes around. Sometimes there's a kind of purity test. Are you really a climate change activist? Or are you just or are you a hypocrite about it? And charges of hypocrisy are very prominent in all kinds of environmental activism.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not remembering, maybe the psychologist Rene Lertzman who says this, but don't quote me on that. But I'm thinking of a couple of phrases. So climate psychologists have started to realize that often the ways that we're communicating in public spaces around climate change are or have the valences of telling, yelling, or selling. It's very hard to experience any of those as a soft place or an invitation. It's much more likely that we experience telling, yelling, or selling to have the sort of feeling of like a scolding finger or like a, you know, I'm going to push you from this place to this place, or like, hey, buy this thing. And there's a lack of care and authenticity in that kind of like relational, or this way of relating that is fundamentally not really relational. And it's so easy to slip into. It's not because anyone is like doing anything wrong or is coming from a place of bad intention. It's just, that's just how things have developed up till now. And so I think this person that I can't 100% tell you who they are, but I think that they talk about the antidotes to telling, yelling, and selling being mending, befriending, and tending. Mm-hmm. So thinking about the relationality and the care inherent in those alternative options for engaging with climate change.
That's great. And I like anything that rhymes. That's always a helpful way to remember things.
Yeah.
That's good. All right. Yeah, I'm going to have to look up. That does sound like Rene Lertzman, but you know, but there's, I mean, it's a nice problem to have that there's so many people in the space of climate emotions now that it's not just like, well, it must be Rene. Like, yeah. No, there's other people too. And that's a good issue to have.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, you know, in terms of like spiritual practices for dealing with things, you know, when you have, you know, clients, are you sending them away with any kind of recommendations? I know folks like Sarah Jaquette Ray really recommend mindfulness practice as a way of, you know, non-judgmental attention to our emotions. And So I wonder if there's anything, and, you know, you do interdenominational work, but you're also a rabbi. So any practices or from any of the traditions or denominations you're working with that you kind of prescribe to people?
Yeah. So I would say that in my practice, I am not terribly prescriptive. And that's for a number of reasons. One of the main reasons is that I try to really honor the individual who I'm working with, and honor the fact that what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another person in thinking and feeling in the practices in their lives. And that being said, you know, one of my main areas of research and writing, because I also try to do some writing on climate change emotions and climate chaplaincy, is I have a particular interest in trauma and how intergenerational trauma or inherited trauma tends to impact certain groups of people. You know, I'm a rabbi, of course, and, you know, the conversation around epigenetic transmission of trauma is very live in the Jewish community. So one of the workshops that I offer regularly is around climate anxiety and thinking about how, you know, experiences, historical experiences of oppression, of targeted violence, of genocide can make it really difficult for individuals who may live, you know, generations after the key targeted oppression or genocide, still tend to be hyper activated when it comes to thinking about the future and thinking about an increasingly uncertain future. So I just happen to have this this handout from from one of these workshops that I did in Jewish community last week. And so I guess it doesn't make sense for me to hold this sheet up to the camera, so I'll just read it to you. So it's a few columns. And one column is I might tell myself, like a phrase I could tell myself, and then some reinforcing actions. So so one of the phrases that a person for whom intergenerational trauma makes it challenging for them to be thinking clearly about climate change could be, in this moment, I am alive. And then some reinforcing actions are laying on the floor or laying on the earth or doing a body scan, doing conscious breathing, meditation, gentle movement, singing is actually really helpful. Another thing that a person might tell themselves is, it's okay for me to feel. And so some of the corresponding actions, reinforcing actions, crying, screaming, laughing, punching a pillow, moving their body energetically. I'll share one more from this list. I can make plans for a future. And so the reinforcing actions are writing, making art, brainstorming, joyfully scheming with loved ones, finding a community of folks with whom you can share your thinking and feeling. So, you know, I try, like I said, I try very hard not to be prescriptive. I try more to help folks understand their resources and their needs, and then resource themselves to be able to be engaging with climate change from a more sort of easeful and joyful place.
That's really good. Yeah, I like that approach of showing people the resources. Like, all right, then here's a whole spectrum of things you can do and ways to discover what works for you and what doesn't.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind laying on the earth. That was a good one.
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, I'm in New Haven right now. And so I have actually developed a semi-regular practice of laying, you know, on the actual earth, and it's difficult to do it in wintertime. But if, you know, you're in California and there's not too much atmospheric river happening, then yeah, laying on the earth is a really wonderful grounding thing to do. And if you can't access actual earth, you know, laying on the floors is pretty good too.
Right. Yeah. The floor is not bad. It's, yeah, anything to ground seems like literally grounding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. These are all really great practices and so sorely needed right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is all, I really appreciate all this. I'm like, more people need to get involved with this. Yeah. And I mean, do you know of anybody else doing this work? Like you mentioned, there's like a couple people. Do you think it's growing at all?
It's absolutely 100% growing. So are you familiar with the BTS Center? They're located in Maine. And they formerly the Bangor Theological Seminary, a Christian seminary, and then a number of years ago, they shuttered and reoriented their focus towards the intersections of spirituality and the environment, so spirituality and climate change. So last year, I participated in a climate, sort of like a climate chaplaincy support group circle for folks who were working as chaplains, who were interested in working as chaplains, to have a container with which to start to be thinking about some of these issues and in engaging in conversations around spirituality and ritual and pastoral care when it comes to the more than human world and human experiences in the more than human world. And I was very kindly invited this year now to be one of the co-facilitators of these groups. And the number of people who applied the first time, I don't know like how much fold increase there was in the number of people who applied the second time around, but it is massively growing, massively expanding. And I've you know, dropped into a number of divinity schools over the last year to, you know, lecture, offer a one-off class to chaplains or chaplaincy students who are really curious about what does it look like to be an eco chaplain? What does it look like to be a climate change chaplain? So I think in some ways, folks who are attuned to, you know, the climate crisis and have a sort of spiritual orientation or a pastoral lens are maybe moving a little bit ahead of the curve when it comes to just, you know, like the average person. So, you know, chaplains or future chaplains are saying, oh, this is a really significant need that is happening. There is profound suffering, profound fear, profound wrestling with uncertainty that is happening on the individual and community and global level. Like there needs to be more support here. And so I think really the work over the next few years is to help the public understand like, hey, there are climate change chaplains and we are here to support you.
That's very heartening. And to see that kind of growth and an interesting point, it's like, well, okay, so the eco chaplains, the climate chaplains, they're emerging. The public doesn't know that. And so we need to get the word out, which is partly why a podcast is helpful. Hopefully we'll get the word out to a few people.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where people might think, oh, I'm just the election cycle is bothering me or it's war or whatever. And you're like, yeah, it's climate change. You might not realize it, but it's there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, seeing a climate change chaplain is more of a need than people realize.
Yeah. And I would say in many ways, unfortunately, you know, a war, you know, especially thinking about what's happening in Gaza right now. But, you know, there's unrest and wars around the world. And thinking about the American, you know, the upcoming American election, these are all piercingly urgent and painful issues that demand our attention. And because of that, they often are a distraction from the broader and deeper and even more profound and more long-lasting issues of the climate crisis. And so, yeah.
Yeah, and I know, speaking of the long-lasting part of it, is there's now increasing numbers of people who have anxiety about bringing a child into this world. And I know I have a lot of my students who are, for the most part, undergraduate students. And so people in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, and a lot of them are like, nope, I can't see myself doing it. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I get it. But also, if everybody said that, then we don't have more people. And yeah. So people are amazing. And yet there's so much anxiety about bringing another person into the world. And so, you know, even thinking about intergenerational trauma and stuff like that. So I'm wondering, how do you work with people who are expressing that kind of fear or anxiety about having children?
Yeah. So a lot of my one-on-one work with clients is with folks who are in their 30s, folks in their 20s, folks in their 40s, who are wrestling with whether or not to become biological parents, or, you know, who are pregnant themselves with their first child, or their spouse is pregnant with their first child, or they've already had a child and are wrestling with the question of whether to bring another child into the world. I'm thinking of one client who I remember what they said. So I remember because it was so piercing, like piercing to my heart. So they said, am I capable of preparing, this was someone who was expecting their first child. And they said, am I capable of preparing my child to live a joyful, meaningful life in a world filled with change, destabilization, and grief? There's a strong voice in my head that says no. So, you know, there's really like meaningful and difficult work to be done with folks who are in that position where they are really acutely wrestling with like the deepest existential questions of life and moral questions of life. And so, you know, one of the practices that we tried, that I tried with this one client, was inviting them to imagine their future child and getting into a little bit of a dialogue with that child. And, you know, asking that child questions about, like, you know, would you be okay with the fact that I was wrestling with whether or not to bring you into the world? Like, you know, is it okay for you to be born? Is it okay for you to live? What messages do you have to share with me? And, you know, this sounds kind of woo and weird and, you know, that kind of sort of deeper dialogue work is often done in the context of some sort of like meditation and guided visualization, which, you know, like I said, I try to really customize the practices in a given session to the client's needs and desires. So I don't like force someone to get into a dialogue with their imaginary child if that's like really not their jam at all. But there's a lot of power in the imagination, I think. So, you know, that's my work with one individual. And then, you know, I was mentioning to you before we started recording that that I'm leading a support group specifically for Jews and allies of folks who are wrestling with this question of whether or not to bring a child into a climate changing world. And why I find why I sort of moved, you know, or expanded my offerings from only working with individuals into support groups is because when we're wrestling with these very, very powerful and deep and painful questions, and when the wrestling itself is countercultural, because the question of like, should I have a child, especially in Jewish community, is profoundly countercultural. Right. Hearing other people who are also doing this wrestling is deeply healing, is deeply grounding, and it invites other people to be witnesses to one another. So, you know, it's not only chaplain as witness, it's other individuals who are going through the same thing as witnesses too.
That's great. Yeah, a great service. And it really is interesting how some traditions are very pronatalist and some are just like, eh, whatever. And, you know, that's up to you. And yeah, Judaism, Catholicism, there's a couple that are like, oh no, have all the kids, as many as you can. You have to do it. So yeah, I think the idea of having a support group and is a great way to do it. And I appreciate the dialogue example. That's not too woo for me anyway. I'm sure some people are like, I'm not going to have an imaginary dialogue with my unborn child.
Well, you're based in San Francisco. So yeah, maybe
exactly.
You're in the epicenter of woo in some ways.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's hard to be too woo for me and for a lot of the people I know out here, like all the crystals and the astrology, like, yep. Okay.
Yeah.
It's all just the more, the merrier. And if any imaginative exercise you have, we'll give it a try.
Yeah.
And even if only 10% of them work, that still works, you know? So
yeah,
I appreciate that.
It's strong. Yeah.
And in general, it sounds like you're really working. I mean, and you know, as you mentioned, you're doing interdenominational work. And that kind of flexibility with such a great variety of practices is just wonderful. I really, really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, geez, I don't want to keep you too long, but I do have one question and that I've been asking people lately. And it's what gives you hope these days? And hope, I don't know, it's kind of a complicated word. It's a noun, it's a verb, or just a positive vision of the future. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I mean, you know, you're immersed in some of arguably the biggest challenges to ever face humankind, really. And I mean, at least one of the biggest. And so doing that can be a lot. And then people get pessimistic. I know some people who have just the biggest hearts and yet are just like, yeah, things are doomed. Anyway, we're going to just have to just enjoy the ride. And then there's other people out there like, no, I still have hope, or at least glimmers of hope. Yeah. So what gives you hope these days?
Yeah. So like you said, I think hope is you know, it sounds great when you just say hope, like, you know, who doesn't like hope? Yeah. Who doesn't feel hope? But if I can share maybe one learning that I've had in the course of this work, and then maybe one like personal learning around hope. So the professional learning is, I had a client a while back, and she shared with me, she said, I don't think of myself as a hopeful person. And what she meant by that was that she didn't have an unambivalently positive relationship with hope. And so when we explored in the course of our chaplaincy sessions, how this showed up on the level of the body, she said that her body felt guarded against hope, and she felt a real sense of resistance to it. And when she did manage to feel hopeful, it brought up a feeling of scarcity for her. Like she was clutching at this feeling of hope, and she was really afraid that it would evaporate. Mm. And so, you know, what I realized was that she thought of hope as something that she should be reaching for. And because of that, for her, hope seemed to be carrying this kind of implicit value judgment, and sort of like, you know, a little bit of that wagging, scolding finger of like, should. Mm-hmm. And so what I realized is that we're not always well served as individuals, as a collective, when we treat hope as the ideal state to reach for, or as the ideal place to rest in. And, you know, so hope as an ideal doesn't necessarily nourish all of us, or doesn't necessarily actually sustain all of us. So, you know, if hope doesn't necessarily nourish all of us, or ground all of us, or sustain all of us, what does? And, you know, I think that's a real invitation into curiosity, like to ask each other, what does ground you as you engage with our changing world? What does sustain you? What does nourish you? And so I think that's like actually an invitation for all of us to step into the sort of like climate chaplaincy space, which is really like a space of care and curiosity for one another. Mm. And then I'll just speak to sort of my own personal experience with hope. So this learning came in, you know, from a challenging time, out of the death of my father, who died about a year and a half ago. And he died after 5 years of battling terminal prostate cancer. And so for most of my life, I really, really wanted a closer relationship with my dad. And a closer relationship than he was really capable of. I would say he was guarded. He was protective of his own vulnerability for his whole life. And, you know, one of the most important things that you learn in therapy is you can't change people, right? And as long as you're hoping to change them, you'll just keep being disappointed. You'll keep being hurt. And something that I learned as a hospital chaplain is, you know, we have these visions that people, as they're approaching death, will just like profoundly change, or be profoundly changed by their illness and death. And what I learned as a chaplain is that's actually not true usually. Like most people tend to die the way that they lived, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. And so, you know, I knew all these things. And it's true that my father and I, throughout his life, were never as close as I wanted. And what's also true is in the last few weeks of his life, you know, he was in and out of the hospital. And in those experiences, in those places, in those moments, we were actually able to be a little gentler with one another. We were able to be more humorous with each other. We were able to just experience a little bit more ease and empathy in our relationship. And he, you know, I cared for him physically, all of the difficult and messy pieces that come with end of life. And, you know, my mother and I were with him when he died. And I was pressing my forehead against his forehead, and I was telling him that I loved him. And so as I was, you know, in the days and weeks and months after, in the space of deep grief, what the words that came to me in thinking about our relationship throughout my life and the shift, the small shift in our relationship around his death, what came to me was a phrase: it wasn't enough, but it was also enough. And so, you know, I think the lesson for me was I just kept showing up. I kept showing up with an openness to the possibilities of closeness, but without the expectation or demanding of change. So I showed up with openness, but without necessarily expectation. And I think that that's sort of another way of saying hope. So what if, you know, what if hope isn't just like holding on to or holding out for an ideal? Like, what if hope isn't like demanding the most ideal relationship or demanding the most ideal society or demanding like a non-climate changing world or a safe world? What if hope is just creating the conditions in which meaningful change, no matter how small, can happen?
Yeah, that's beautifully said. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, I can't imagine a better way to think of what hope is instead of just a kind of naive optimism or just holding out for some idealized world, but really creating those conditions for that world to show up with no attachment, with no expectations for it. And I know that's, you know, a big value in Hinduism. You talk about non-attachment a lot, right? Non-attachment to outcome, totally committed, but not attached to the outcome. Showing up, 100% commitment, no attachment to what comes of it. So yeah. Very well said. I know some people, who I ask them about hope, they're like, no, don't even, I've heard it too much, especially in this climate space.
Yeah.
People are like, hope again. And I know a climate scientist, Kate Marvel, she has a nice line. She's like, we don't need hope. I'm tired of hope. We need courage. Mm. And it's like, oh, that's a nice way to kind of just be like, shut up about hope already. but I really appreciate your answers. Those are really good. And geez, all this has just been wonderful. I have had a great conversation, learned a lot, and I'm just really very excited. One of the things that gives me hope is the burgeoning field of climate change chaplaincy.
Yeah.
And this is really inspiring work. So thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sam. I'm so glad to have the chance to talk about this and to be in conversation with you.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll have to have you back sometime because I think, you know, really just scratching the surface. And it'd be nice to get a report on how these things keep growing in your own practice and in the wider world of climate change chaplaincy. So it's so important, so sorely needed.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll check back in on how you're lying on the ground practices.
Oh, I think it's going to go pretty well. I do like a good lying down.
Yeah.
wonderful. Rabbi Ora, thank you so much. This has been such a treat.
Good to be with you.
And thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll be back with some more conversations for you soon. In the meantime, take care and be well.